Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The Taliban breakthrough into Afghanistan's second largest city. What does this mean for the future of the country as the U.S. withdraws?
Then,
after years and years of infrastructure week, we're on the cusp of an infrastructure decade.
How trillions of dollars of investment could transform America. Plus,
all over this planet, wildfires are burning us alive.
Feeling the heat. Filmmaker Lucy Walker talks about her new documentary on California's deadliest fires. Also ahead,
it's pretty stunning, and it should get more attention than it's gotten.
Former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara and Walter Isaacson discuss Trump's efforts to subvert the 2020 election. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Golodriga in New York, sitting in for Christiane Amanpour, who will be back next week. The Taliban have just taken control of Herat, Afghanistan's third largest city. Now, this happened just moments after they charged into its second largest. Local officials saying there is fighting on the streets of Kandahar as militants battle government forces. It's yet another day of major gains for the Taliban, who have also taken control of the city of Ghazni just this morning. That means 11 provincial capitals have fallen to them in less than 1 week. This map highlights just how dire the situation is, and it's likely to get even worse. The latest U.S. intelligence assessments warn that the capital of Kabul could fall to the Taliban by mid-November. That is, according to officials. Joining me now on these shocking developments is Barnett Rubin. He's a senior fellow for the Center on International Cooperation and served as senior advisor to the U.S. Special Representative for Pakistan and Afghanistan. Also with us is veteran journalist Ahmed Rashid. He's written extensively about the Taliban. Welcome, both of you. Barnett, let's begin with you, because you had been someone who had been supportive of the president's decision to withdraw troops. Obviously, we knew that that would be met with some resistance from the Taliban. Did you expect this to happen so quickly?
No. I mean, I'm not surprised that the Taliban would try to do this, but I have been surprised at the speed of the disintegration of the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces, which were, which the United States spent, I don't know, hundreds of billions of dollars building up. And in his speech announcing the withdrawal, President Biden said that they have the money, the equipment, and the training that they need to resist. I believed that at that time. So I still don't fully understand why this rather large and well-equipped army is disappearing so quickly.
And in addition to the symbolism here of taking so many cities in such a short period of time, Ahmed, let me turn to you, because what does this suggest that the future holds for the country there? And can you possibly answer Barnett's question of what happened to Afghan forces in terms of resisting the Taliban?
Well, I think one of the major causes was a lack of leadership. President Ashraf Ghani has not been able to provide the kind of leadership that the military needed and even that the population needed. He's barely left his office. Only the other day he left for one visit to the northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif, but he hasn't been out anywhere since then. He's hardly given any pep talks to the population. And now, of course, there's a huge crisis in Kabul itself, with tens of thousands of refugees pouring in from outlying areas, even coming in from the north, which is now entirely in the hands of the Taliban, except for Mazar-e-Sharif. So you have now a refugee crisis. And remember, Afghanistan is landlocked. So there's now really a stranglehold that the Taliban have over the city.
And it's happening in the midst of a pandemic. Let's not forget about that. Barnett, in terms of Kabul, we talk about the significance of Kandahar. That obviously is the birthplace of the Taliban. But Kabul, the capital, is something entirely different. And there are reports of real concern for the city within the White House and the administration. The New York Times headline just an hour ago, U.S. asked Taliban to spare its embassy in coming fight for Kabul. It does appear that the Taliban is leading the charge here.
Yes. Kabul is not comparable to any other city in Afghanistan. It has 6 or 7 million people. That is to say, it's maybe the size of Los Angeles. Kandahar, the second largest city, has 500,000 people. It's huge. It has infrastructure and so on. And it has a population with a very, very large share of anti-Taliban groups. So it would be a much bigger operation than taking smaller cities. But the fact is, Kabul, as Ahmed said, Afghanistan is landlocked, and the Taliban have captured nearly all of the border crossing points, so cutting off the government from its revenues and from trade. It still has one with Uzbekistan and one with Pakistan. Kabul is kind of an island in the middle of this landlocked country, and it depends on the things coming over the border for its supplies and so on. So if the Taliban do take Mazar-e-Sharif and/or Jalalabad in the east, which we haven't heard much about, which is the main supply route from Pakistan to Kabul, then it really will be isolated.
We have heard from President Biden on this very issue, and though there does seem to be surprise and a lot of concern within the White House, he is standing by his decision and says he has no regrets over it. Let's take a listen to what he said just a few days ago.
We spent over $1 trillion over 20 years. We trained and equipped with modern equipment over 300,000 Afghan forces. And Afghan leaders have to come together. We lost thousands, lost death and injury, thousands of American personnel. They've got to fight for themselves, fight for their nation.
Well, Barnett, we see how that fighting's been going in just the past few days, and if that's a sign of what's to come in the future, there are some dark days ahead for Afghans. The president stands by his decision. Do you stand by your earlier view that it was a right decision?
Well, I think in a contradictory way, the fact that the security forces are evaporating like this after 20 years of building them up and training them sort of justifies a withdrawal. The security forces were supposed to be our ticket out of Afghanistan. They would be able to take over the fight. You can't say it was early after 20 years, and it wasn't sudden because President Trump agreed to do this well over a year and a half ago. But apparently everyone and acted as if they had been totally unprepared for it. The fact is the military, as far as I can see, the U.S. military trained the Afghan security forces in a manner which assumed that the United States would always be there, because they trained them in such a way that for their enablers, airlift, logistics, intelligence, communications, and so on, not combat, but all those other things that you need to have an army, they needed American advisors and foreign consultants, foreign contractors to carry out those functions, because they were unable to do that themselves. And now that those people have left, the army, the individuals in it are well trained, but it doesn't have apparently it does not have the infrastructure to act as an army, in addition to the lack of leadership that Ahmed Rashid talked about. And I should say that lack of leadership extends a bit further in that President Ghani and those around him in the palace refused to believe that the United States was actually going to withdraw from Afghanistan, even after President Trump's Secretary of State Pompeo went to Doha for the signing of an agreement under which the U.S. promised to get out of Afghanistan, and so did not adequately or seriously prepare and did not negotiate with the Taliban in Doha in a manner as if the regime was actually going to be at risk.
Right, so, but many, yourself included, had been arguing for a regional strategy as well, right? That the onus wasn't just on the United States, but on neighboring countries, including Pakistan. And there are Afghans today who are blaming Pakistan for not doing enough to fight back on the Taliban, or at least to warn them about their position and any advances they may be making. But Ahmed, let me turn back to you, because there is a debate as to what, if anything, was to show for the 20 years that the U.S. had been in Afghanistan. And many, like yourself, argue that, in fact, there is a lot to show. There was a lot of promise there, and particularly in terms of education and work opportunities for girls and women and journalists. And you talk about this in a piece that you wrote. Today, vibrant networks of radio, television, online media reach all 34 provinces. Female journalists in a country that previously barred women from education number over 1,100. What happens to them now?
Well, that's a really a huge question, because for the first time, there has been a sort of development of a middle class in the urban areas, in the cities. And young people in particular have really benefited from it, from education and job opportunities and traveling abroad on scholarships, etc. And the real tragedy is that this whole generation that was a great deal of Western money was spent on bringing up these youngsters to take charge of their country. You now have a group, the Taliban, which when they ran the country in the 90s, they were incapable of governance of any kind. And right now we fear very much that looking at the Taliban and at their leaders, there's very little technical ability to govern, you know, how they will govern their country. We just don't see the cadres and the personnel to do that, which, of course, means that there will be increasing insecurity.
Barnett, I'll leave the last word to you, and that is just the question of what, if anything, came out of these peace talks in Doha that we had been covering for so many months between Afghan officials and the Taliban?
So far, nothing has come out of them. Right now in Doha, there is a meeting not just of the Afghan negotiators on both sides, but also of the special representatives of all the major countries that are concerned, and they are trying to come up with a common initiative which would include U.S., Russia, China, India, Pakistan, and Iran. Which, of course, is as difficult as it sounds, though they have some convergent interests in Afghanistan. However, there are reasons. I'm not predicting this. The Taliban might make a huge mistake and try to capture the city of Kabul militarily, but that would cause an incredible amount of destruction and suffering, even if they ultimately succeeded. They might want to surround it and then make demands in Doha for virtual surrender.
Well, these advances are happening quickly by the day and even by the hour, as we've seen develop today. I want to thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it. Well, we turn now to correspondent Clarissa Ward, who is in Kabul. And Clarissa, you just heard that conversation. What are you seeing and hearing from your sources on the ground about these advancements that we're seeing from the Taliban?
Well, it's absolutely an alarming situation, Bianca, and no one could have predicted just how quickly the dominoes are all falling. Herat now has fallen, the country's third largest city. The Taliban there confiscating large amounts of military hardware and weaponry. And Kandahar, the second largest city, but also the sort of spiritual birthplace of the Taliban, the original capital for the Taliban's Islamic Emirate, is on the brink of falling. We were there last week. We were at a wedding hall that have been transformed into a sort of frontline position for Afghan forces. That position now has been completely overrun by the Taliban. And the MP who we spoke to while we were there, I've just spoken to him again, he says the city hasn't fallen yet, but it will. He said that there are teams of 12 to 15 fighters of the Taliban who have essentially broken through the front line in the western part of the city and are now causing chaos, popping up in the central square, popping up outside the governor's house, shooting in the air, and really contributing to this sense of a complete lack of control. The situation here in Kabul, Biana, is still relatively stable. It's calm. I think a lot of people are skeptical that the Taliban would try to push their luck, if you will, by making an advance on the city. But still, people here see the writing on the wall, and they are desperate now to get out of the country, particularly anyone who has worked with the military, who has worked with the U.S. Embassy, who has worked with NGOs or Western publications. And so there is definitely a growing sense of dread and panic in much of the country, Biana.
And you're seeing that people are being killed in the wake of the U.S. withdrawal that are associated with the government, that the head of communications there just a few days ago. In terms of how the people on the ground are reacting, we spend so much time focusing on women and girls who have made such large inroads over the past two decades. How apprehensive are they about what's to come?
I think it depends where you are in the country, but if you're talking about young women in urban centers who are educated and who over the 20 years have enjoyed some real advancements in their lives in terms of being able to work and being able to leave the house and being able to get an education, they're of course deeply, deeply concerned about what happens. And you know, you speak to some of these women and there's this wrenching kind of sense of how do you make the choice between staying in a country that you love and that you care about and that you want to serve and want to contribute to, but also knowing that you can't have a proper life anymore in that country if indeed the Taliban does completely take over. And by the way, I should add that that's a luxurious position to be in. Many other women don't have the option of leaving at all, and they are looking potentially at a very bleak future indeed. Obviously, there are other parts of the country. I'm thinking rural areas where women don't tend to be educated, no matter whether the territory is held by the government or the Taliban. For them, it's unlikely to have as much of an impact on their life. But for many others, there is absolutely a sense of real dread.
And I don't know what we just heard. It sounded like gunshots or something behind you. But Clarissa, please stay safe.
Gunshot, yeah.
We are so happy and lucky to have you on the ground there, and we will continue to follow the story with you. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, now we turn to the U.S. domestic agenda, where a gigantic investment in the country's infrastructure could be just around the corner. This week, a bipartisan group passed a $1 trillion bill through the U.S. Senate. $1 trillion. Hot on its heels was an additional $3.5 trillion budget blueprint, something unheard of just a few years ago. Well, this one, however, is a lot more partisan, and Democrats are hoping to push it through in a process known as reconciliation. This level of investment is a throwback to the era-defining work of presidents like FDR, whose New Deal programs changed the face of America in the 1930s. So let's dig into what's in these bills with Heidi Heitkamp, the former Democratic senator from North Dakota. Senator, thank you so much for joining us on what is appropriately described a historic moment here. This is something that the president sought out to achieve early in his administration. He had many naysayers, many of those within his own party. How significant is this moment when you look at that bipartisan $1 trillion deal?
This is huge for President Biden. He promised to be a president for everyone. He promised to bring the country together and do bipartisan deals. And the fact that this was so broadly bipartisan, not just marginally bipartisan, is huge. He's got to get it through the House of Representatives yet. And there is some pushback from more progressive members there. But this is huge. And you can tell how big it is in terms of a political victory by how much the former president hates this deal and is threatening Republicans who supported it.
It is quite stunning to see 19 Republicans were able to ignore or overcome President Trump's constant push for them to not pass this bill. And yet here we are. Can you break down for us what this means for everyday Americans? You're talking about traditional infrastructure here, roads, bridges, internet access, broadband access as well.
Well, in my part of the world, which is rural America, the inability to have stable broadband has really diminished economic capacity to grow. And so that's not true in North Dakota. We've made huge investments here. But throughout the rest of the country, in rural America, this is a huge package and hopefully will bring hope and some economic development to rural areas. But more importantly, you know, everybody's concerned about debt and deficit. You can pass on debt by not taking care of your infrastructure. And this is really for that next generation who won't have to pay now for the bridges, who will inherit infrastructure that is modernized, whether it is in our mass transit and passenger rail, or whether it is just roads and bridges and preparing for the next century. And so I liken this package to what happened when Eisenhower passed the interstate highway system in our country. And so this is huge, not only for a bipartisan win politically for President Biden, but it is huge for all parts of our country. And that's why you had 19 Republican senators supporting it. They can't very well go to a ribbon cutting for a new bridge unless they actually stood on the floor of the Senate and voted for this bill.
And yet not one of those senators voted for the other larger package, the $3.5 trillion so-called human infrastructure package that many progressive Democrats see as pertinent. And the reason that they allowed and agreed to the initial $1 trillion package to pass was because they've invested so much into this package. Now, Republicans are saying that this is social welfare and this is costing way too much for the U.S. government. President Biden seems to think both can pass through. Let's take a listen to what he said.
It's not a short-term stimulus. It's a long-term investment in American families. My Republican colleagues have argued that long-term investments in physical infrastructure will grow the economy and reduce inflationary pressures. And I thank them for that. They're exactly right. We agree on that.
So they agree on that, but not necessarily the larger bill. And this is including health care, education, supporting for working families, climate mitigation. How optimistic are you that a bill in its current form will pass through the Senate and Congress?
Well, I mean, obviously, the reconciliation package has passed by the slimmest of margins. And so now this is headed over to the House and we'll see what happens there. But it's interesting because one of the big challenges that we have right now is with labor. And one of the big things, one of the reasons why we don't have a robust labor, new people coming into the labor market is because of many of these things that are in reconciliation, whether it is expanding our K through our early childhood education, paying for daycare. A lot of these policies are incredibly popular with people in the United States of America. I think how successful the Democrats are going to be is how successful they are in messaging this. If they seed the messenger lane to the Republicans, what's going to happen is you're going to hear about inflation, you're going to hear about deficit and debt, which they didn't care about for 4 years during the Trump administration. And if the Democrats are really smart, what they're going to do is they're going to talk about what this means for families when getting back to work and exploration of opportunities for people's children. And then that all important, how do we take care of our seniors and how do we take care of our kids? And so, again, these are popular programs. The debate will function and I think be determined by who wins the messaging war.
But you see not only Republicans making the argument about the deficit, but moderate Democrats as well. You yourself were a moderate Democrat. I'm wondering if you would have supported this bill in its current form. You don't have guarantees from Senator Manchin and Sinema. They moved forward with the blueprint, but not a final package. Would you have, and how would you sell it to your constituents?
Well, I think it's really important to break it down and to make sure that when what you're looking at is actual investment and it's not just giveaway money. It's not just a program that would necessarily make a constituency group happy, but really doesn't add to the value of building our country. And so, you know, it's really important to understand, I think, that the difference between investment and reckless spending. And debt and deficit comes in a lot of forms. When we don't educate our kids, that adds to additional debt into the future. When we don't provide for families. Right now, interestingly enough, we are seeing the growth rate, the population growth rate in our country really stagnate. How do we build our population? How do we build that next generation of workforce? And that's what I would talk about. I would talk about the impacts that it could have on families. And I also might just say, look, No one cared when they were handing out billions of dollars in tax relief to some of the largest financial institutions. That's their priority. My priority is helping American families. And I think when you win that war, that message war, I think you can, in fact, get the hearts and minds of the American public, the vast majority of the American public, to support you. And so it will be up to Sinema and up to Senator Manchin, both great friends of mine, to kind of find their way in all of that. But I think they also, you know, I always like to say we get criticized a lot, but we are New Deal Democrats. We believe that when we invest in people, this country grows and gets better. And I think that's the message that will carry the day if we're successful in delivering it.
Final question. What is it about this president that you think enabled him? He's not fully there, right? But to even get a $1 trillion bipartisan deal is a pretty big deal. He's used another word in between that, but you know what I mean about a big deal in President Biden. How has this been something he's been able to achieve when presidents before him, including Trump, have not?
Well, I mean, that's a little unfair because we passed a WERDA, we passed a lot of highway bills when I was there with President Obama. And so infrastructure is always the sweet spot for bipartisanship. The problem that the former President Trump had, was that he wanted it all his way and was never willing to sit down and actually have a conversation with moderates. This president knows the Senate, has worked with the Senate. He has a lot of friends in the Senate. And you should also look at who led this effort in the Senate. It was senators who were leaving, who just wanted for a moment to get something done. And I think that level of frustration, we're here to do with the work of the people, I think that really broke through. I think it's going to be interesting to see whether you can do more bipartisan efforts based on how much the former president, how successful the former president is in pushing back and making life miserable for the 19 who actually supported it.
Yeah, there are many progressive Democrats who say this may be a one and done kind of a deal to get any sort of big bipartisan package on the table. But hey, we'll take one in this day and age. Senator, thank you so much for joining us. Heidi Heitkamp, we appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care. Well, the Senate's infrastructure bill would also give a long-awaited pay raise to federal wildland firefighters. This is a high-priority item for Senator Dianne Feinstein, as her state, California, is battling its second-largest wildfire ever, the Dixie Fire. Firefighters are exhausted and traumatized, trying to stop the blazes that are devastating the land and destroying people's homes. Oscar-nominated director Lucy Walker saw this up close when she embedded with California firefighters during the mega fires of 2018. Her new documentary is called Bring Your Own Brigade. Let's take a look.
I've never seen anything like it.
The fire equivalent of an ice age.
Like peering into Dante's Inferno.
And it's only going to accelerate.
This is only the beginning.
We're surrounded by fire. My dad put his hand on my shoulder and he said, don't leave.
Whatever you do, do not let that building burn down.
Evacuate.
Everything was on fire. The looks on their faces, they were sure they were gonna die.
Run for your life.
I've never seen that look in anybody's face.
And Lucy Walker joins me now from Los Angeles. Lucy, welcome to the program, and congratulations on a compelling and really, really powerful film that I recommend everybody watch. It was painful at times, but so important. And I was struck by your background, and perhaps this is what led you to this story. You were not a California-raised citizen. You had moved, you'd been a transplant from the UK, and had been shocked by the sheer number of massive wildfires and the seemingly, you know, benign responses or unassuming responses from so many who are just used to it.
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in the UK in London, and I'd also lived in New York City. And in those places, you think of fire as a problem that we've solved hundreds of years ago. So when I moved to California, I was scared. I was confused. Why is the hillside on fire, and why can't they put those fires out? I didn't understand this landscape and how fires work here and the strain that the firefighters are under, but I got to know residents of firefighters caught up in these huge fires. I thought, oh my goodness, what is going on? And of course, it's getting worse and worse.
Yeah, there are so many videos that you've compiled into this piece and images of people driving along the highway with massive fires to the left as if it's some sort of horror movie that we're watching. In fact, it was reality. And you really hone in on the November 2018 California fires in both Malibu and Paradise. 88 residents were killed. Tens of thousands lost their homes and were displaced. And you spent a lot of time with these firefighters. And I have to say, they are heroes, and the emotional toll, the physical toll that this took on them, why was it so important for you to highlight and focus on that?
Well, because I think that it's easy to forget quite how extreme the circumstances that are expected to work are. And with these big wildland fires, you're not going home every night. Your shift may be 70 days long, and you may come home for one day and then be sent right back out again. And with fire season going longer and longer, in fact, they say there's no fire season anymore, because with climate change, with extreme events, and with the other factors that are pushing these fires, because I learned that it's not just climate change that's having a huge impact. You know, we're asking them to do more and more, and the strain is absolutely breaking people. And I was really moved by that. And also, they have information for us that we're not listening to. So I was fascinated that they actually, you know, have incredible ideas, and there's a wealth of knowledge about how we can do better and how we don't have to be having these huge fires, or when the fires do come through, they won't be as destructive to, you know, structures, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of homes being burned, you know, but when the fires come through, the homes don't need to burn if we're listening to people about the building codes. And so something that's very shocking in the film is you see the fire chief of Paradise, where 85 people were killed, 18,000 structures were lost, being ignored in his recommendations for building codes. And I think that's something that was really astonishing to witness as well.
And this happened at the end of the film, which is the first time I believe we actually see you, because you attended the city council meeting and the vote. You would think, and you hone in on this, that a community that has lost and experienced so much, given facts and data points and analysis showing that homes built after a certain year, 2008, withstood many more fires than those built prior, and not having shrubbery around their houses would protect them. And yet, most of those people voted no. What do you make of that? And what does that say about our current environment?
That's right. I was so shocked that I put myself in the movie. I don't normally put myself in my documentaries. I've made many documentaries, and I'm always behind the camera. But in this case, my own journey of discovery became part of the story. And there was a moment when I was sitting in this town council meeting in Paradise, which had burned so tragically, a little bit like Greenville we lost just this last week with the Dixie Fire, which started actually right next door to where the fire that destroyed Paradise started, same Feather River Canyon. These places burn all the time. But in the case of Paradise, we lost 85 residents and even more structures. And I'd really assumed that the people most affected by these fires would be doing anything they possibly could so that when the fire came again, as it is actually right now, you know, they'd be, their homes might not burn and the evacuation route might stay open and all these compounding effects. And yet, you know, human beings are funny creatures and we have our own psychology. And also we have political systems and structures where, you know, sometimes the decisions are all sort of dislocated from the impacts, and it's tough to sort of make these decisions. And I really got to thinking about how with climate change, as we learned in this report this week, you know, that seems to be really here already, and these bigger problems like these wildfires, as with the pandemic, you know, it's really hard to get everyone on the same page and making decisions, even when you know what's sensible and you know what's going to save lives. The path to implementing that can sometimes really not work out. And I think that might be the biggest takeaway from the film. But there is something that we can learn. There are some things we can do about the fires that I really look at in the film. We talk about fire suppression. We talk about Native Americans and our indigenous fire practices that actually are a whole different way of living with fire as a tool and not always the enemy.
I was taking notes. I learned so much myself. And I, like you, entered and started watching this film thinking that this was all attributed to climate change. You say and explain that it's much more complicated than that. These fires go back centuries. And you also talk about the many solutions and many factors behind them. There are solutions on the table. It's just a matter of people willing to take them and listen to the data, to the facts. I'm glad you made that through line to the crisis we're in now with COVID. Quickly, and in just the final minute, if you can explain why it was so important to you to highlight these two really different cities in within one state, one a red city, a paradise, largely voted Republican, and then Malibu, typically voting Democrat, one home values at 200,000, one's at 2 million. Why was it important to highlight these two cities?
That's right. The film looks at these two fires and embeds right in them, but it doesn't stop there. It follows through. So you follow these residents and firefighters ongoingly. And I wanted to use these fires as a case study. It was never my intention just to show you the fire and say kind of, wow, that's absolutely horrifying. It was always to get to the bottom of what's actually going on, because when I moved to California, I didn't understand. And I felt like if I don't understand, maybe other people don't too. And they'd also, like me, want to figure out, are we safe living here? What can we do? What's really driving these fires and what's it really all about? And so what was really useful, I think, about using those two fires as a case study is they're really different communities. They're opposite ends of the state, opposite ends of the economic and political spectrum. And yet, of course, people suffer in just the same way. And Right. Some of the things that you see play out are just the same, and some things you see play out are quite different within, you know, the different communities with different means. And I thought to get a big understanding of how fires are affecting us in California and also the world. We've just seen these terrible fire in Greece, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just in the Western United States. We have a real problem right here. And I think looking at the two fires, you kind of get to understand the whole issue much better.
And that we all burn the same, right? Thank you so much, Lucy Walker, for highlighting this important, important piece of work here and the work ahead that we have, we all have to do to contribute to ending these massive wildfires. Thank you. We appreciate your time.
Thanks. Oh, no, thank you.
Well, frightening details. That's how Senator Dick Durbin described the testimony of former acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen. Rosen testified over the weekend about what happened at the Justice Department during the waning days of the Trump administration. Our next guest, former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, says the revelations were pretty stunning. And here he is talking to Walter Isaacson.
Thank you, Biana. And Preet Bharara, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
The former acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen just gave some astonishing testimony, 7 hours of testimony, about Donald Trump's attempt to subvert the election. Walk us through that testimony and your thoughts about it.
So I'd love to see a transcript. I'd love to get my hands on that hot transcript. I've seen some reporting about what he said, and what we do know, even though we don't have the full testimony, all the language and all the information, it's pretty stunning, and it should get more attention than it's gotten. And basically what Jeffrey Rosen details as the acting attorney general in the final days and weeks of the Trump administration, after even Bill Barr, a staunch supporter of the president, left for various reasons that we can speculate on, says that again and again, the president of the United States, and some of this is documented by contemporaneous notes taken by his deputy, tried to get Jeffrey Rosen, the head official of the Justice Department, the top legal officer in the country, to take actions to overturn the election. Among other things, Donald Trump was sort of conspiring with, and I can use that even though it's a legal term, with another official lower down in the Justice Department, Jeffrey Clark, who was the acting head of the Civil Division. And they had come up with a scheme whereby they would get Jeffrey Rosen, the person you mentioned, to author a letter, to sign a letter to Georgia officials and to other officials, basically saying there are problems with the election without evidence, and that you would be within your rights to convene a special session and reject the election. So you have multiple occasions where the president was trying through his chief legal officer of the country, Jeffrey Rosen, and other people around Jeffrey Rosen to try to get action taken by the election. One of the most interesting bits of reporting about what apparently happened is that at various junctures, Jeffrey Rosen stood his ground along with the deputy attorney general at the time, Rich Donahue and said, no, we're not going to do this. We can't snap our fingers and change the election. To which, and this to me is very stunning, to which Donald Trump says, and it's part of a pattern, I get that. Just say the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me. So, and I can go on about other details that have been reported, but in essence, I think the people who are saying this was something of an attempted coup are not wrong. They're not far off the mark. I don't think it's an exaggeration. And but for people who said, we're not going to do this. And by the way, also the reporting about the testimony is that at some point, Trump was going to replace Jeffrey Rosen with this more, partial person, Jeffrey Clark, who was going to go along with the program. And that was met with the threat of mass resignation at the Justice Department. So I know we've heard this tale before. We know about Donald Trump trying to subvert the election, perpetrate the big lie, calling Georgia officials himself. But this stuff is in many ways more stunning than the old stuff.
And what laws might that be violating?
So that's an interesting question. It could be violating, you know, various laws in various states. I think it's a little bit tough to do that because the argument would be made, and I don't know all the facts and I don't know all the circumstances. I don't know the local laws in Georgia, and there's some federal laws that may apply. But, you know, we trust presidents to act within norms with respect to their Justice Department, to stay out of prosecutions and enforcement actions specifically, particularly when they're for the benefit of that person in office personally. And the president, as Jeffrey Rosen and others, you know, responded in this way for this reason. The president was acting in his personal capacity as a candidate. Was he interfering with an election? Was he obstructing a proceeding? I think we need more information for that. But the defense would be, I was doing things, even though they're out of the ordinary and not within the norm, and might have been an impeachable offense. It may be that I was allowed to direct my people to do whatever they want. And at the end of the day, by the way, it didn't happen. This is the repeated defense that Trump and his allies and lawyers have used with respect to the findings in the Mueller report. At the end of the day, the thing didn't happen.
You mentioned that Richard Donahue took notes at the time. You know Richard Donahue. Tell me about him and what do you make of those notes?
So I do know Richard Donahue and had a very good opinion of him. When I was U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, he was the chief of the criminal division for a period of time in the Eastern District of New York across the river. Professional, good lawyer, integrity. He took notes like anybody does. The history of our understanding of President Trump, myself included, is that there are often concerns about what he's going to say and how he's going to represent conversations later. That's why Jim Comey took contemporaneous notes. That's why the Georgia official recorded the phone call. That's why when the president called me and I didn't return the call, I briefly considered taping the call, but I thought that was a bridge too far. So it was a smart thing that he did. The notes themselves, I think, given that they were contemporaneous and that Richard Donahue is a person who I think is honest and trustworthy, probably accurately reflect what the president said.
Jeffrey Clark, who you mentioned was the person that Trump relied upon at the Justice Department. Is there a case against him that you see and what you know of the testimony and notes?
Yeah, I don't see such a case. I think there might be questions given what additional evidence comes forward if he was violating some oath as an attorney, if he, you know, was trying to make arguments in court, although they didn't happen, right? These are all drafts. And I think it's a little bit more difficult, to bring an ethics charge or for a bar association to examine what he was doing. But again, Justice Department officials have wide discretion and authority to do things, which includes unethical things. I think what he was attempting to do was to circumvent the chain of command. What he was attempting to do was to circumvent norms, and most importantly, to undo an election without any facts or evidence in cahoots with a political candidate, not a president, not the person who's his superior, but a political candidate. And that's bad enough without there having been a criminal law violated.
Do you consider this almost an attempt at a coup?
Yeah, so some of these words are charged, and we've heard over the last number of years people use the word treason casually, and some people don't like the word insurrection, although I think January 6th was an insurrection. Coup, I know, to various people, scholars, including yourself, has a particular meaning. We apply that word to other countries. And whether you call it a coup or not, I think it tends to fit what was happening here. You had an election that was decided, definitive evidence that election was decided in a particular way. There was due process in dozens, scores of legal proceedings, virtually all of which went against the president. And so I don't know what else you call it when you have people at a high level in office who have been voted out of office attempt to remain in office and positions of power against all law, against all regulation, against all facts. You know, I think attempted coup is not a bad phrase to capture that.
With everything you've seen about the attempts to overturn the past election, including the January 6th insurrection, are you surprised that the system held?
Yes, I think that's it's a good way of saying the glass is half full. I'm not surprised so much as relieved. And if you engage in counterfactual, you're a historian, Walter, and you know that you think about things and you think about the lives of the people that you have written about and covered exhaustively, you change a couple of facts. How different would the world have been?
So are you saying we're just lucky? It could have gone the other way?
Bit. Yeah, I think very, look, if Mike Pence and Jeffrey Rosen and Bill Barr and a number of other people and the head election officials in Georgia and maybe some folks in Arizona, a handful of people, had done what the president of the United States at the time wanted them to do, I don't think we would have lost the republic necessarily, but we would have been much closer to it.
Should we rely on luck?
No, we should not. We should not. But, you know, it takes not only, you know, policies and laws and regulations, it takes good people. And I know, again, that sounds unsatisfactory to folks, but, you know, when Nixon did what he did, there was an understanding in the country by both Democrats and Republicans that there needed to be accountability and there needed to be reform and there needed to be an inquiry. And now we're at a spot, I mean, that's the most damage I think that Donald Trump has done to the country, that he has caused people to put proximity to power over sort of the strength of the republic. And I don't know how you get out of that overnight. I think it helps for there to be electoral defeats of the people who, you know, stick their head in the sand and spout nonsense and garbage, whether knowingly or unknowingly. And I think the Select Committee, if it can do its work with two Republican members, although they're not members of good standing in the Trump Republican Party at the moment, can shed light on a lot of these things. And I think over time, as we've gotten back to certain norms in the Justice Department and elsewhere, what you hope is that good Americans will come to the view in increasing numbers and an increasing majority that what happened on January 6th and what led up to January 6th is unacceptable in this country.
Walk me through what must be going through Merrick Garland's mind. What are his options? What do you think he should do?
So that might take a while. Merrick Garland is a smart person. He has a very capacious mind. And I don't envy him his job and the difficulty of his job, because he's balancing multiple things. And I think he's trying to steer a path of doing the right thing in the right way. And there are some institutional considerations that he holds dear. You know, he was a former member of the Justice Department at a high level and also a trial attorney there. And so there are certain issues relating to deliberative process privilege and executive privilege that some people who are Biden supporters don't like, because some information is not coming out. And there have been decisions made about continuing to represent the president of the United States, former president of the United States, in some litigation that some people who are on the other side of the aisle from Donald Trump don't like. But then on the other hand, he's trying to make sure that he's transparent with Congress. So with respect to the things we're talking about now, what's very interesting about Richard Donahue's notes, the former acting deputy attorney general, it doesn't appear to be that was released or is being looked at as part of an internal DOJ investigation to see what crimes have been committed or what norms have been breached, what ethics rules have been violated, but rather in response to requests from Congress for that information. So, you know, I think he has an interest in making sure that bad conduct comes to light and there's some transparency. I don't know how much interest he has, and people can debate this, in making sure that there is a complete review and reporting of and holding accountable of people who engaged in this semi-coup-like behavior towards the end of the administration. I think he would be well served to figure out a way to do that that doesn't derail him from other things like civil rights priorities and other issues that are important to the department. But I think it's a little bit of a tough line for him to walk.
Governor Andrew Cuomo resigned this week after a lot of sexual misconduct allegations and investigations. But there's also a story by Ronan Farrow, great reporter in The New Yorker this week, that Governor Cuomo called Valerie Jarrett of the Obama administration to try to interfere with an investigation you were doing. Tell me about that, and tell me if there's some things comparable to what Donald Trump did.
Yeah, so I've drawn that parallel. You know, it is not a good thing for a political official to in any way try to bring their influence to bear on people at the Justice Department or other political figures to put pressure to bear on members of the Justice Department to engage in enforcement action against somebody or to hold off on an enforcement action against somebody. You know, you're not supposed to use the Justice Department to protect allies and to harm and penalize and punish adversaries. And so the one difference between some of the things that Donald Trump did and what happened in my case was during the time in 2014, as Ronan Farrow outlines, and it's confirmed by multiple officials at the White House and the Justice Department, the almost former governor of the state of New York didn't like being investigated. And that is true of a lot of people, whether they're well-known or powerful or not. And apparently, I am informed, made a call to one of the top advisors to the president of the United States at the time, Barack Obama, Valerie Jarrett. And it became clear to Valerie Jarrett by her own testimony in the article that it was an inappropriate call, that it was intended in some way to cause me to get brushed back from the investigation I was overseeing, which was being conducted by career prosecutors and investigators, by the way, I should say. And she immediately changed the subject or ended the conversation, and she reported it immediately to the White House counsel. The White House counsel reported it immediately to the Deputy Attorney General of the United States. And the Deputy Attorney General, as recounted in the article, informed me and said, make whatever use of this is appropriate in your investigation. And we proceeded in that way. Now, yeah, the analogy, I think good faith and reasonable people, I think is hard to criticize. And that is you have a person who is in some investigative jeopardy. Ultimately, charges were never brought. We never brought charges. You have someone who's in investigative jeopardy, who tries to pull a political lever to prevent independent prosecutors from doing what they're supposed to do. And that's wrong. And it wasn't allowed to go any further. The difference between that case and what we've seen in the Trump administration is that members of the White House, unlike Valerie Jarrett, were solicitous of this kind of conduct. Mark Meadows, at the request of the president, almost certainly made his own phone call. So rather than shutting down the request and saying, no, that's not appropriate, I'm not allowed to get involved, you're talking about this in your capacity as a candidate. The Justice Department is supposed to be independent on enforcement actions. No, he took the baton and ran with it and made his own calls to the Justice Department. So while there's an analogy between what two different politicians have done, there's no real analog with respect to how the Justice Department handled it.
Tell me about your phone call with Donald Trump.
So the phone call, so I don't know how many folks are aware of this. You know, I stayed on as U.S. attorney at the request of Donald Trump because I thought I was going to be able to do my job independently, which is the mandate of being the U.S. attorney anywhere, but certainly in the Southern District of New York. And he began calling me a couple of times during the transition. I reported those phone calls, made a note of those phone calls. But then he called me when he was actually the sitting president of the United States in March of 2017. And a message was left by the secretary to the president. And I thought about what I should do. Now, at the time, there were calls for investigations of Donald Trump based on the Emoluments Clause and some other things. I had no relationship with Donald Trump. Ordinarily, if this was going to be something relating to my job, it would be the attorney general who would be calling me. Jeff Sessions was nowhere to be seen. This seemed to be a side phone call to me. And based on my sense of how the world works, and also for my protection, and also for Donald Trump's protection, where we wouldn't know and be able to prove why he was calling, what he was saying in the call, how would that look? So I respectfully called the secretary back and said, I decline to speak to the president unless I know what it's about or involves the attorney general. And the next day I was asked for my letter of resignation. That decision, by the way, which likely cost me my job and the job that I love, but I had no entitlement to serve in any longer than I had, that decision was borne out as correct time and time again by the experiences of Jim Comey, the experiences of the Georgia officials, the experiences of Jeffrey Clark. I have no doubt. I mean, at the beginning, I would say, I mean, I'm not sure how this would have played out. I have no doubt in my mind now, given how Donald Trump and Mark Meadows and others that you've mentioned have tried to weaponize the Justice Department, that at some point, if I had played along with Donald Trump, wanting to have a side relationship with the sitting Senate-appointed, Senate-confirmed U.S. attorney in Manhattan, which has jurisdiction over his properties and his businesses and his organization, that I would have been asked to do something inappropriate at some time. By the way, the other thing that's worth mentioning in this whole business of the end of the Trump administration is there was a sitting U.S. attorney in Atlanta who, it's now being reported, maybe Jeffrey Rosen says something about this, was forced out, was made to quit in a way that's parallel to mine and other people's experiences, apparently because he wasn't doing enough to cast doubt on the election in Georgia. So nothing good could have come of having a relationship and being cultivated by the sitting president of the United States when you're supposed to be an independent-minded prosecutor.
Preet Bharara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Walter. Good to be here.
Well, that is it for now. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.